own sake. As if in art, the sensory were not the bearer of something intellectual, which only shows itself in the whole rather than in isolated topical moments. Art records negatively just that possibility of happiness, which the only partially positive anticipation of happiness ruinously confronts today. All light and pleasant art has become illusory and mendacious. What makes its appearance aesthetically in the pleasure categories can no longer give pleasure, and the promise of happiness, once the definition of art, can no longer be found except where the mask has been torn from the countenance of false happiness. Enjoyment still retains a place only in the immediate bodily presence. Where it requires an aesthetic appearance, it is illusory by aesthetic standards and likewise cheats the pleasure seeker out of itself. Only where its appearance is lacking is the faith in its possibility maintained. The new phase of the musical consciousness of the masses is defined by this pleasure in pleasure. It resembles the reaction to sport or advertising. The words enjoyment of art sound funny. If in nothing else, Schoenberg's music resembles popular songs in refusing to be enjoyed. Whoever still delights in the beautiful passage of a Schubert quartet, or even in the provocatively healthy fare of a Handel concerto, Grosso, ranks as a would-be guardian of culture among the butterfly collectors. What condemns him as an epicure is not perhaps new. The power of the street ballad, the catchy tune, and all the swarming forms of the banal has made itself felt since the beginning of the bourgeois era. Formerly, it attacked the cultural privilege of the ruling class. But today, when that power of the banal extends over the entire society, its function has changed. This change of function affects all music, not only light music, in whose realm it could comfortably enough be made innocuous. The diverse spheres of music must be thought of together. Their static separation, which certain caretakers of culture have ardently sought, the totalitarian radio was assigned to the task. On the one hand, of providing good entertainment and diversion, and on the other, of fostering the so-called cultural goods, as if there could still be good entertainment and as if the cultural goods were not, by their administration, transformed into evils. The neat parceling out of music's social field of force is illusionary. Page 275. Just as the history of serious music since Mozart as a flight from the banal reflects in reverse the outline of music, light music, so today in its key representative it gives an account of the ominous experiences which appear even in the unsuspecting innocence of light music. It would be just as easy to go in the other direction and conceal the break between the two spheres, assuming a continuum which permits a progressive education leading safely from commercial jazz and hit songs to cultural commodities. Cynical barbarism is not better than cultural dishonesty. What it accomplishes by disillusion on the higher level, it balances by the ideologies of primitivism and return to nature, with which it glorifies the musical underworld, an underworld which has long since ceased to assist the opposition of those excluded from culture to find expression and now only lives in what is handed down to it from above. The illusion of a social preference for light music as against serious is based on that passivity of the masses which makes the consumption of light music contradict the objective interest of those who consume it. It is claimed that they actually like light music and listen to the higher type only for reasons of social prestige. When acquaintance with the text of a single hit song suffices to reveal the soul functions this object of honest appropriation can perform. The unity of the two spheres of music is thus that of an unresolved contradiction. They do not hang together in such a way that the lower could serve as the sort of popular introduction to the higher, or the higher could renew its lost collective strength by borrowing from the lower. The whole cannot be put together by adding the separated halves, but in both they appear, however distantly, the changes of the whole, which only moves in contradiction if the flight of the banal becomes definitive. If the marketability of the serious product shrinks to nothing in consequences of its objective demands, then on the lower level the effect of the standardization of success means it is no longer possible to succeed in an old style, but only an imitation as such. Between incomprehensibility and inescapability, there is no third way. The situation has polarized itself into extremes which actually meet. There is no room between them for the individual, and the latter's claim, wherever they still occur, are illusory, being copied from the standards. The liquidation of the individual is the real signature of the new musical situation. Page 276. If the two spheres of music are stirred up in the unity of their contradiction, the demarcation line between them varies. The advanced product has renounced consumption. The rest of serious music is delivered over to consumption for the price of its wages. It succumbs to commodity listening. The differences in the reception of official classical music and light music no longer have any real significance. They are only still manipulated for reasons of marketability. The hit song enthusiast must be reassured that his idol are not too elevated for him, just as the visitor to Philharmonic concerts is confirmed in his status. The more industriously the trade erects wire fences between the musical provinces, the greater the suspicion that without these the inhabitants could all too easily come to an understanding. Toscanini, like a second-rate orchestra leader, is called maestro, if half ironically, and a hit song. Music maestro, please. Had its success immediately after Toscanini was promoted to marshal of the air with the aid of the radio. The world of that musical life, the composition business which extends peacefully from Irving Berlin and Walter Donaldson, the world's best composer by way of Gershwin, Sibelius, and Tchaikovsky, to Schubert's B minor symphony labeled The Unfinished, is one of fetishes. The star principle has become totalitarian. The reactions of the listener appears to have no relation to the playing of the music. They have reference, rather, to the cumulative success with, for its part, cannot be thought of unalienated by the past spontaneities of listeners, but instead dates back to the command of publishers, sound film magnates, and rulers of radio. Famous people are not the only stars. Works begin to take on the same role. A fan pantheon of bestsellers build up. The programs shrink, and the shrinking process not only removes the moderate good, but the accepted classics themselves undergo a selection that has nothing to do with quality. In America, Beethoven's Fourth Symphony is among the rarities. This selection reproduces itself in a fatal circle. The most familiar is the most successful and is therefore played again and again and made still more familiar. The choice of the standard works is itself in terms of their effectiveness for programmatic fascination in terms of the categories of success as determined by light music or permitted by the star conductors. The climaxes of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony are placed on the same level as the unspeakable horn melody from the slow movement of Tchaikovsky's Fifth. Page 277. Melody becomes the mean 8-beat symmetrically treble melody. This is catalogued as the composer's idea, which one thinks he can put in his pocket and take home, just as it is ascribed to the composer as his basic property. The concept of the ideal is far from appropriate to established classical music. Its thematic material, mostly dissected triads, does not at all belong to the author in the same specific sense as in a romantic song. Beethoven's greatness shows itself in the complete subordination of the accidentally private melodic elements to the form as a whole. This does not prevent all music, even Bach, who borrowed one of the most important themes of the well-tempered clavier, from being examined in terms of the category of ideas, with musical larceny being hunted down with all the zeal of the belief in property, so that finally one music commentator could pin his success to the title of tune detective. As its most passionate musical fetishism takes possession of the public valuation of singing voices, their sensuous magic is traditional as it is the close relation between success and the person endowed with material. But today it is forgotten that it is material. For musical, vulgar materialists, it is synonymous to have a voice and to be a singer. In earlier epochs, technical virtuosity at least was demanded of singing stars, the castrati and prima donnas. Today, the material as such, destitute of any function, is celebrated. One need not even ask about capacity for musical performance. Even technical control of the instrument is no longer really expected. To legitimate the fame of its owner, a voice need only be especially voluminous or especially high. If one dares, even in conversation, to question the decisive importance of the voice and to assert that it is just as possible to make beautiful music with a moderately good voice as it is on a moderately good piano, one will immediately find oneself faced with a situation of hostility and aversion whose emotional roots go far deeper than the occasion. Voices are holy properties like a national trademark. As if the voices wanted to revenge themselves for this, they begin to lose the sensuous magic in whose name they are merchandised. Most of them sound like imitations of those who have made it, even when they themselves have made it. All this reaches a climax of absurdity in the cult of the master violins. One promptly goes into raptures as the well-announced sound of a Stradivarius or Amati, which only the ear of a specialist can tell from that of a good modern violin, forgetting in the process to listen to the composition and the execution, from which there is still something to be had. The more the modern technique of the violin bow progresses, the more it seems that the old instruments are treasured. Page 278. At the moments of sensual pleasure in the idea, the voice, the instrument are made into fetishes and torn away from any functions which could give them meaning. They meet a response equally isolated, equally far from the meaning of the whole, and equally determined by success in the blind and irrational emotions which form the relationship to music into which those with no relationship enter. But these are the same relations.